Do aliens exist, and are they among us? Are weird creatures lurking in the darkness? Do evil entities hide in the shadows of your bedroom while you sleep? Join us as we explore all this and more on the Warped Reality Podcast.
What's going on, all you crazy ghost enthusiasts out there? It's your boy Ghost Joe. Welcome to episode 11 of the Warped Reality Podcast. I have an awesome show planned for you guys tonight. Same great segments, same great people involved. And I have an awesome interview with Dr. Elliot Van Dusen, who is a certified parapsychologist. He is an author, the director of Paranormal Phenomena Research and Investigations Group, vice president of Ghost Project Canada, and he was also, well, is also a retired Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer. It's a great interview, guys. I know you're going to love it. Please stay tuned for that. But on with the show. Now let's get on with some haunted eBay, shall we? So our first item is entitled Paranormal Spirit Inhabited Necklace. Then it says, not a haunted doll, in parentheses, succubus. The price is $19.98. It's free standard shipping, and it's located in Galleon, Ohio. So let's read the description, shall we? My daughter is 12 years old and has abilities to communicate with spirits. The spirits she communicates with on a daily basis seem to find her at the oddest times and places, mostly in the form of dolls, but other spiritual objects as well. I have finally convinced her to downsize her collection because she wants to focus on having more time to spend with her favorites, some of which are a jealous type and require her utmost attention. The spirit in this particular necklace is named Serenity. My daughter purchased these particular spirits from a woman here on eBay 3 years ago. These particular necklaces bring forth many different types of activity, from luck, fortune, protection, and positive emotions, dreams, and visions. These spirits and their activity can be summoned by carrying them in your pocket or purse, or wearing them on your neck. My daughter says that this particular necklace will summon a very attractive female who will enter a male's dream by seduction and pleasure. That's quite interesting. So what do you guys think? Do you think you're going to want to bid on this item? I don't know. It's pretty different. A 12-year-old saying that they communicate with spirits. That's not unheard of course. And it's nice to see that the parent, whoever posted this, is believing the child and encouraging it. So I like that too. So yeah, it also says here, eBay's policy does not allow for the sale of intangible goods such as ghosts, demons, spirits, incantations, blessings, curses, etc., nor for the sale of items with intangible effects attached to them. For this reason, please understand that this is the sale of a necklace only, and the included story is not attached to the necklace. Well, that's an interesting disclaimer, isn't it? What do you guys think? So listen, guys, I hope you really appreciate the trouble I go through to do this haunted eBay segment, because it is painstakingly crazy to sift through all this stuff on eBay, because it is, I mean, there's so many haunted doll listings on here. It's just ridiculous. And I really don't want to pick those out, you know, just because there's so many of them. So I'm going to wait for one of them to really jump out and talk to me. I mean, well, not really, you know, because then I think I might give up this podcast, because that would be a little too much. But the next item is entitled Vintage Estate Haunted Vanity Mirror Set Portal Active Paranormal. Please read. And the starting bid is $65.99. It's a buy it now price of $95. So, and it is, let's see, $8.80 for shipping, and it's in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. So, yeah, so check that out. So, This vintage vanity set was purchased at an estate sale in Northeast Pennsylvania. The family inherited their aunt's possessions, and although beautiful, they didn't keep anything. Their aunt was a vain and selfish woman, never had a family, and was obsessed with her own selfish needs and looks. They weren't close and just felt her presence among everything she left behind. This vanity set being one of the items they didn't like. It was one of her favorites and used it often. She was particularly strict about anyone touching it, as to not break her mirror that she looked into so often. She also had a strict rule of how it was placed when on her vanity, sitting just a certain way. They noticed after she passed that it would always be set up in her order if they had left it sitting randomly, as if she had straightened up after them. She also had a strict rule of not sitting the brush face down, as to not ruin the bristles. When they moved some of her items, they did just that, since she would have hated it, and when they returned, it was turned upright. It freaked them out and wanted this gone. Clearing items, they often smelled perfume and felt the presence of someone over their shoulders. Upon bringing it home, we did investigations with the mirror, comb, and nail file. Our equipment fluctuated from small spikes to high on the EMF and Mel meter. The K2 would jump up and down from green to red. The REM pod would not only turn green, but occasionally we'd get a bright white flash, then red blinking. If you hold the mirror besides the electrical charge, you get, "There are times it appears as if the outline of a woman's face is present. A miserable-looking woman seems to glare out. My daughter and I can see her, but my husband and son can't, and our dogs don't like to be in the same room as the set. The aroma of perfume has appeared when we put the items on our table, and the chills are definite when around them." I tried the experiment of allowing the items on our table. I placed the brush upside down, and when I came down in the morning, it was laying upright, just the way she liked it. She definitely is still possessive of her set that she looked into so many times during life, and apparently still does. We didn't feel anything evil, just a mean demeanor of a woman who owned them. The atmosphere definitely changes when around these, from a clean, fresh breath of air to a heavy, hard-to-breathe aura. That one's an interesting one, guys. If it wasn't so much money, I would probably I would probably buy this one because that's pretty interesting, and it's a very vintage old set here, definitely antique-y looking. So yeah, so check that out, and if you happen to buy it, let me know and tell me your experiences at 845-379-1331, or you could email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. All right, everybody. And for the final object we have here is Haunted Creepy Oil on Canvas, Active Spirit, in parentheses, The Angel by Teresa Oates. And it's 24 by 30. The price is $1,995. And it's free standard shipping, and it's coming from Chico, California. So let's read the description, shall we? Okay. So the description goes like this, everybody. Attention eBay, this listing is for tangible oil on canvas painting and is for entertainment purposes only. I cannot guarantee a paranormal experience and cannot be held responsible for any paranormal experiences you may have. Haunted Creepy Oil on Canvas, Active Spirit, The Angel by Teresa Oates. Knocking on the canvas like a drum in the late hours of the night, the spirit within the painting titled The Angel is restless. The wails of a woman wanting to be free can be heard from the living room where her frame currently hangs. I've gotten very little sleep in the past weeks. I don't want this thing in my house anymore! Exclamation point. The dichotomy between the maniacal laughing and crying is just unbearable. She's definitely a malevolent spirit. I know that much. Painting is surrounded by a heavy gold tone frame, bringing out the light hues around the sultry yet dangerous visage of a woman. It's not at all comforting, the choice of dark palette the artist chose to use. It makes the central figure all the more unnerving. I desperately want this out of my house. Please feel free to ask me about this haunted painting. I will try to answer to the best of my knowledge. Haunted artwork was created professionally and will be fitted into a 4-section box to ensure safe delivery. So, yeah, if this is such a crazy haunted painting and you want it out of your house so bad, why are you charging $1,995? That's quite a lot of money to get rid of something that terrifies you. But, yeah, to each his own. And now for my favorite segment of the show, here's April with April's Creepy Corner.
Hello, spooky friends. This is April's Creepy Corner, and in this episode, we are talking all about something that actually creeps me out, and that is spontaneous human combustion. Spontaneous human combustion, or SHC, is used to describe instances when a human, either living or recently dead, seems to burst into flames without an external source of ignition. It is argued that SHC can be caused by an individual's behavior or habits, such as alcohol consumption or even acts of God. Let's delve into a few reported cases of spontaneous human combustion. Case number one. The woman in the ballroom. In 1938, Maybelle Andrews was at a party with her fiancé when flames suddenly erupted from her as she stood at the top of a staircase. There were many witnesses at the party who actually saw that this event took place. Case number two, the dragon woman. Jeannie Saffin, age 61, sat with her family at her kitchen table on a normal evening in 2007 in North London. A blue flame allegedly emanated from her stomach as she began roaring like a dragon. The kitchen had no damage, but her sweater had totally melted. Police never determined a cause, but family members stick to their story and continue to say that they know what they saw. Case number three. On the morning of July 2nd, 1951, a St. Petersburg, Florida resident named Pansy Carpenter went to deliver a telegram to her tenant, 67-year-old Mary Hardy Reeser. She found the doorknob hot, and so she immediately called the police. What is known is that Mary was nearly completely cremated, with only her skull, spine, and left foot remaining. The rest of her body was ash. Her foot was found still inside of a slipper. The chair that she sat in showed minor signs of fire damage, as did nearby items, but overall, the apartment showed few signs of fire. The case was investigated, but no one knows what really happened. The FBI report concluded that Mary had taken a sedative that night and most likely fell asleep in the chair while smoking and became victim to what sometimes referred to as the wick effect. That is when fat and other bodily tissues burn quickly and hotly. So these cases are usually explained by the fact that the body becomes ignited from some outside cause, such as burning clothing or mattress, chair, etc. Once the body starts to burn, there is enough fat and other inflammable substances to permit varying amounts of destruction to take place. Sometimes this destruction by burning will proceed to a degree which results in almost complete combustion of the body. Many, however, have questioned how the generated heat required to cremate a body could leave so much of the surrounding area untouched. A specialist was called in. His name was Wilton M. Krogman, a physical anthropologist, to give his professional opinion. While his report cannot be found to this day, he was apparently skeptical of the accidental death conclusion. The world will probably never know what happened, as this remains an unsolved mystery. Altogether, about 200 cases total have been reported worldwide since the 1600s. There are several features common to most, if not all, of the cases. Again, that is extensive destruction to the body with little to the surrounding areas, and if body parts do remain, they tend to be distal limbs, especially legs and feet. This contrasts with normal fire deaths, where limbs are generally first to be consumed by the fire. Majority of spontaneous human combustion cases happen indoors, leaving a smelly, oily residue on furniture and walls, and greasy, ashy remains. Most cases are elderly females, and it happens during the evening hours. Very strange, and so the mystery remains. I'm not sure where I stand on this topic, but I certainly will not be burning any candles anytime soon. Thanks for listening, and stay spooky.
Thank you, April, for that awesome, very informative, and very terrifying April's Creepy Corner segment. So, without further ado, here is my interview with Dr. Elliot Van Dusen, author, parapsychologist, retired law enforcement. I mean, what hasn't this guy done? Very well respected, very smart guy. You're going to love this interview. Check it out. Dr. Elliot Van Dusen.
How's it going?
Not too much. How's it going with you?
Pretty good, man. Oh, actually, good. much better than normal because I actually just started my vacation yesterday. So,
perfect.
3 weeks away from the jails, you know?
Nothing wrong with that.
You're a retired Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer, right? How long are you with them? You know, were you in a specific unit or?
Yeah, I spent 15 years with them. I did mostly major crimes, which is in the RCMP's world, it's homicide. I was posted to Penticton, British Columbia, Yellowknife Northwest Territories, Chester, Nova Scotia, and then I got promoted downtown Halifax. I've done a bunch of different units. I did general duty, which is just like your patrol officer. I did a crime reduction unit, which are fairly new units that they created back in 2005, 2006 to help reduce crime. So those type of units target prolific offenders. And if they're on conditions, if they breach those conditions, you arrest them, bring them back to jail. It was an interesting study, actually. So it decreased certain types of crime, but overall the crime rate was the same because you're just charging people with breaches and things like that before they can commit the break and enters and theft from vehicles and things like that. So it was interesting. Crime rates kind of stayed the same, but they were less serious offenses. Then of course, up in Yellowknife, I did homicide for 5 years. Then I came down back to Nova Scotia, did general duty again. And then, I ended up doing general investigation section, which is all your sex assaults and robberies and basically jack of all trades, master of none. And then when I got promoted, it was back to major crimes. But Halifax is divided up into homicide and sex crimes. And so this time I went to sex crimes. And then I finished off on a unit called emergency management section, which is basically in charge of any sort of natural disasters that occur. Any sort of major incidents that occur. So if it's a police involved shooting or anything like that. And of course we work with other partners in the province as well. So the military, intelligence agencies, public safety. And yeah, that was pretty much it. But most of my time was spent on homicide, which is what I always wanted to do. So yeah, I was pretty happy with that.
You know, what's crazy too. I mean, I've never been to, I mean, I was at Canada only a couple times on a cruise, only for a few hours. You know, actually, you know, the cruises went to Nova Scotia and Halifax.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and we actually, you know, me and my friend were like, you know what, let's explore a little bit. You know, let's like go into the town instead of staying in like the tourist area, you know? And people actually get killed in Canada. Like everybody's so nice there. it's amazing. You know, I mean, I think every single person that we walked by in the street said, "Hey, how you doing?" to us. And we were like, "What the hell is going on here?" You know, like we're from New York City. Like we're not used to that.
No, it's true. I've been to New York City and I know what you mean. People kind of mind their own and they're not as friendly. And all you can hear are the vehicles honking all the time, which you don't hear that here. Yeah. Certainly some differences for sure. Yeah. I mean, certainly there's homicides. It's nothing like down in the United States, of course, because we don't have the population. Right. The entire state of California has more people than our entire country. So the population difference is huge. So yeah, definitely a lot less violent crime here.
Yeah, actually it was funny too, because you know, like I had said, we were walking down the street and everybody's like, hey, how you doing? We're like, oh, hey, how's it going? You know, everybody was really cool. And then, you know, we finally make our way home and everything. And we were taking a cab, you know, from where the cruise lets out to our house. And we get in the cab and somebody cuts off the cab, New York City cab. And he's like, ah, you effing a-hole. Like, really? We're back in New York City. you know, like, that's it. We're back.
Yeah.
you know? It's just like, I mean, and I've always heard of everything, you know, from that Bowling for Columbine. I think it was Bowling for Columbine, where Michael Moore went over there and he's like, yeah, everybody leaves their doors unlocked. We're like, wow, that's amazing. You know, it must be nice to live in like a country that's just, you know, that nice, you know, where you don't have to really worry too much about that stuff. So, so that was always cool. So as a police officer, did you ever experience any paranormal experiences as a police officer?
Not on duty. And for most of my career, no. Towards the end of my career, when I had about 2 years left, that's when I started, investigation that I did in Exeter, Rhode Island, which I wrote my first book on, called Evil in Exeter. And that was about a residential haunting that a family was experiencing. I've been to a lot of cool spots like Penticton, BC. My first posting is actually home to Ogopogo, the lake monster, because Lake Okanagan runs from Vernon down to Penticton. So Penticton is the most southern part of Lake Okanagan. So of course on night shift, I would drive around and try and see if I see anything or if I ever heard any witnesses. I'd try and track them down, but nothing. Then when I was up in Yellowknife Northwest Territories, there was a flying community called Wati, about 350 kilometers from Yellowknife. And they believed that there was a Bigfoot type creature that would take away bush camp workers and children. And they call him Naga. And the English word for him is Bushman. There was also a crazy UFO sighting that lasted for about two and a half hours while I was up there in a northern community called Delaney. And the RCMP officers, one of them used to be an air traffic controller. The other one was a semi-professional photographer, so really good, strong witnesses. They checked, of course, all the radars with Edmonton International Airport, Yellowknife Airport, their local airport operator. Nothing was showing up on radar. They actually had to talk to NORAD, who dispatched two fighter jets up there. Once the fighter jets got up there, the objects disappeared. They actually called in the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, which is the equivalent of your CIA, within the following days to come up and debrief the police officers that witnessed it. So that was pretty cool while I was working up there. And then in Chester, Nova Scotia, it's known for a couple of different things. There's a ghost ship called Teaser that people sometimes see in the water. So, of course, on night shifts, I'd always hang out by the water, but never saw any ships on fire. And then there's a headless nun that walks between East Chester and Chester on Highway 3. And of course, night shifts, I'd patrol that highway up and down and never saw anything suspicious there. And that's pretty much my extent of while I was on duty. Now, I've witnessed stuff off duty. Before I joined the RCMP, there was a haunted house in Kentville, Nova Scotia. That was really interesting. And then, of course, towards the end of my career, there was the house in Exeter.
I just found out recently. I just, you know, went to the bookstore, you know, since sometimes I work the midnight shift. So, you know, working in jail and stuff. And, you know, sometimes everybody's sleeping and stuff. And, like, I have to stay awake, so I'll get a book. And so I went to the bookstore and I got a couple books, one of which is a book on haunted areas around where I live, near where I live. And I just found out that there's like this huge UFO Bigfoot hotspot, like 5 miles from my house.
Wow.
So I'm definitely going to have to check that out before I go back to work. You know, I don't know if I want to go by myself at night, but I think I'm going to do it anyway, you know, just for the hell of it, just to see what's up.
Oh, definitely. But, that'd be cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just because it's right there, you know? So, you know, do you think that being in the law enforcement field, do you think that that affected your study and investigations negatively or positively in that way?
No, I think it affected it positively for sure. You know, I've certainly taken the interview training that I've received from law enforcement into my parapsychological investigations. You know, just certain things like doing in-person interviews are extremely important. You know, you can read people's body language. You can also see if there's any sort of influences going on at the house. You know, when you're talking to somebody on the phone, you could have the husband nodding his head or the wife nodding her head and kind of influencing their responses to you. So, you know, in-person interviews certainly is a skill that helps. Also, you get the odd case that involves children. And with the RCMP, I received, because I was on the sex crimes unit, I received like child interviewing techniques as well. So, you know, that's certainly valuable as well in parapsychological investigations. And I went to university, right? So, I mean, university is all about teaching your critical thinking skills. So I kind of had a good foundation in that, I guess, while I started law enforcement, but I would say I probably, you know, tuned up those critical thinking skills. You know, when you're at a crime scene and you're trying to find a particular piece of evidence, it's similar to a haunting where, you know, you got to try and rule out natural explanations. And sometimes we do, you know, we've had a couple cases this year actually, where we were able to resolve it. There was one, I was doing an event at the Fortress of Lewisburg. It was kind of a public ghost hunting event. And I was asked by Haunts from the Cape if I would come down and assist them. So I came down and one lady stopped me after my lecture and showed me a ghost photo. And, I was kind of thinking, okay, here's going to be like an orb or something like that, right? What most people think. And she showed me this really cool photograph, and it looked, you know, like a face and eyes and mouth, and it looked almost too good to be true. And I told her, I said, listen, I said, I'm not saying your photo's fake, but, you know, even before I retired, our technological crime unit was having difficulty determining what's real digital evidence and what's not. Just because there's so much technology out there now. I mean, you have the deep fake technology now where they can take a snippet of your voice and then create this whole video that's not really you. So I showed her the app that you can add faces that look like ghosts into the photo and stuff like that. I said, but if you're interested, send me your photo and like we'll take a look at it. So she did. And it turned out it wasn't fake. But what had happened is, couple of my investigators said, you know what that looks like? It looks like somebody pushed their face against the screen. So I had my fiance, Sarah, who is part of Paranormal Phenomena Research Investigation, my organization, freshen up her makeup. And we actually were able to recreate that photo. And when you zoomed in on the ghost photo that the lady had given us, you can see that the image on the screen is only on the screen, because when you zoom in close enough, you can see the squares from the screen and there's nothing behind it. But if you look right to the corner where the, not the lantern, not in the 1800s, where the chandelier is hanging down and you zoom in on that through the squares, you can see the rest of the chandelier. So wrote her back and said, listen, I noticed you have a pool in your backyard. And this, we were able to recreate this photo. Is it possible that somebody may have pushed their face up against the screen? And you know, she wrote back and said, you know what, I actually appreciate you guys looking into this. Now I can sleep better at night. I think you're right. The kids are always asking for drinks and juice boxes and stuff like that. It's totally possible that one of them, you know, pushed their face up against the screen. And it's just the way that the light was hitting it, because I had her take some additional photographs that day. So this is like 2-3 months later. And you could just barely still see the face on the screen. Now, if it was, you know, a real ghost, chances of you capturing that ghost on a photograph twice, especially over the course of 2-3 months, are going to be pretty slim.
Right. You know, and my thing is, a lot of times I just feel like a lot of people, you know, you go on all these Facebook groups and these forums and stuff, and you know, the second somebody puts up a picture, it's automatically, oh, it's fake. Oh, it's fake. Oh, it's fake. Listen, I don't think all these photos are fake. I try to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. you know, yeah, I'm in law enforcement and I have that, you know, kind of attitude a little bit for, you know, for certain things. But at the same time, there's, to me, nowadays, you're not even going to get 5 minutes of fame for something like that anymore. Well, so you might get your thing on Paranormal Caught on Camera, you know, yeah. which, you know, and that's really it. I mean, or you might get some YouTube views or something like that, but you're not really gonna, you're not gonna make money off of it, really. You're not gonna, you know, it's not like you're gonna become famous for faking a ghost picture or a video. So I just feel like most of those things nowadays, I kind of believe a lot of them, you know, because, you know, like I said, it's just, I feel like it's not really worth it to go into all that just to fake something that you're not really going to get much out of, you know.
It's certainly true. I mean, you're not going to, you know, back in the day where they would throw a homemade UFO up in the sky and take pictures of it and things like that. Back then, you know, you would certainly gain a lot more attention. But, I mean, today, like, you know, Ghostface app is one app you can download, and within seconds you can make a ghost image. So, like you said, it's just so highly and readily available today that it's not worth as much as it used to be back in the day.
Right. So I see that you have quite a bit of training in the parapsychology and stuff. You took a lot of courses and everything, got some degrees. How do these institutions, how do they teach the subject? Do they, you know, do they lean more towards the science side, or do they touch on the spiritual side? Like, how do they actually teach it?
I mean, for the most part, they try and teach it neutrally. Today, a lot of it's done online through Zoom. Ryan Education Center is probably your best spot to go if you're looking for reputable courses. That's all done through Zoom and through the interface called Moodle, which is an online learning platform. There are some that are in class. I took one from University of Edinburgh, which they do in class, but it was, I actually just locked out because of COVID. They forced a lot of the universities to put courses online. So there was two courses that I wanted to do that were only in person. One was Ancient Monsters, which is done by University of Glasgow. So I did that online. And then the other one is a witchcraft course taught by the University of Ottawa. And it was really interesting. It wasn't what you would think it is. It touched on a lot of different things. In fact, I didn't realize that the Nazis had used the occult so much to plan their battles and their attacks and things like that. They were really into the occult. So it was a, you know, really interesting opportunity. When I first started doing it, it was all in class. Nova Scotia Community College here in Halifax was offering a couple of certificates in parapsychology. And my mother saw an ad in the newspaper and she told me about it. And I signed up for it. And that's where I met my colleague and friend, Daryl Walsh, who's a parapsychologist that was teaching at the Nova Scotia Community College. So I took his courses, passed them, and he invited me to his research organization at that time, which was called the Center for Parapsychological Studies in Canada. And from there, I started to get some field investigation experience. And then I kind of continued on with my education after that. Stratford Career Institute had offered a diploma in parapsychology. And there was you know, there's a couple other spots as well, like American International University had offered it at that time. The only problem with parapsychology, unfortunately, is it's still kind of, I guess, disregarded by mainstream science still. It's actually a fallacy that it's a pseudoscience. It's actually a social science, because what we're interested in, obviously, are human experiences of apparitions or survival incidents. And of course, testing humans with extrasensory perception and psychic abilities. So it's actually a social science and has been recognized as one since 1969 by the American Advancement for Science. But yeah, it's, you know, I've been lucky enough to do a mix of in person and online. But right now in today's world, it's mostly online. And like I said, very few universities are actually teaching courses now. University of Edinburgh is probably one of the only ones that actually has a parapsychology program now that you can basically get a concentration in. Other than that, a lot of them have dried up. Even a friend of mine, Lloyd Auerbach, he got his parapsychological degree from JFK University back in the day. And of course, they don't have a parapsychology program anymore.
Hmm. Now, you know, the paranormal, or I'm not sure if you would even say parapsychology, but you know, it's a big umbrella. There's a lot of things connected to that. When you study the parapsychology in these places, do they delve into all aspects, or is it just basically like the spiritual, like the ghost, you know, entity kind of stuff? Like what do they go into cryptids and UFO stuff and all that too?
For the most part, they don't go into that. Now, parapsychology is the study of extrasensory perception, which would be, you know, telepathy, psychic abilities, precognition, retrocognition. Then you've got mind-matter interaction, which is the new term for psychokinesis. So that's being able to, you know, move things with your mind. It used to be called telekinesis, but now it's psychokinesis. And then there's survival, and survival encompasses a lot of different research. There's near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, apparitional hauntings. There's also reincarnation falls under that as well. So you do cover off quite a bit of paranormal topics, but as far as UFOs and cryptids, you know, even astrology, alchemy, all that stuff, they don't normally cover off.
Hmm. Now, what's your thoughts on, you know, cause I've actually been trying to look on Facebook also to try and interview people, about telekinesis and, you know, the kinesis. what's your thoughts on that stuff? Do you believe that there are people that could move things with their mind?
I do. Yeah, I believe in it. I know, you know, there's even some parapsychologists aren't really sure if psi exists or, you know, if psychokinesis exists. I do believe that it exists. A friend of mine, actually, Daryl Walsh there, the parapsychologist that was teaching, he had his own television series back in 2004, 2005. It was called Shadow Hunter, and it was with the Space Network. And he got to interview Dr. Michael Persinger from Laurentian University. He was a neurophysicist. And he invented what they call the God helmet. And what he did is he took a Skidoo helmet and he put electrodes in it. And he would find research participants and he would slowly increase the geomagnetic field. And when it got to a certain level, people would experience apparitions and things like that. So that's how we know that geomagnetics can cause people to see apparitions and experience hauntings. But it was interesting, at the end of filming that segment, he ended up having a private conversation with my colleague, Daryl Walsh. And he said that although he's skeptical of the paranormal, he always thought that if something paranormal happened, that there's something in science that can explain it. Thus, you know, why he enjoyed the geomagnetic work. But he said he had a student that could move a pen across his desk with her mind, and he couldn't explain that. So to hear something come from such a well-respected person, that really like makes me confident in my research. Now, I've only seen psychokinesis from the standpoint that in parapsychology, we believe that when ghosts can open doors and unlock doors and move things, we believe that that is done through mind-matter interaction or psychokinesis. So I have seen that at haunted homes. So that's why pretty much I'm a subscriber and a believer to psychokinesis. And I certainly do believe that people have psychic abilities. I'm not one of them. I don't sense things, and I don't think I'm an empath or anything like that, but I do believe that there are a lot of people tuned into that. And, you know, there's a few different organizations that test people. So you can try and find a reliable medium. The Winbridge Institute is one, the Rhine, Research Center is another one, and the Forever Family Foundation is a third one. And they'll actually, you know, put psychics to the test. And if they can pass their certification, they'll list them on the website as being, you know, a certified and trustworthy psychic.
Wow. Wow. That's cool. And especially since, like you had said, that, what was he, a professor or a scientist?
Yeah.
That,
the neuro yeah. Physicist.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, somebody so heavily into science and he couldn't explain his own students. I mean, that right there to me kind of seals the deal a little bit.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. That's crazy. That's awesome. I hope I could actually find somebody that could, you know, that could come on the show one day and explain it, because that would be pretty cool. So what was it that got you into the paranormal? Can you share like one of your first or, you know, a significant experience that you had had?
Yeah. So what got me into the paranormal, was unsolved mysteries, because like I said, I always wanted to be a homicide detective and, always had a fascination with the paranormal. So unsolved mysteries would always, talk about cold case homicides. And then of course they had the supernatural element to it, where they would do UFO stories and ghost stories and cryptids. So, that show got me really into it. And then I discovered X-Files in 97. I think X-Files came out in 93. But when I discovered it, I thought that was really cool to have two law enforcement officers investigating the paranormal. And, that's what kind of caused me to create Paranormal Phenomena Research Investigation, which is a nonprofit organization that, you know, investigates the supernatural. My first experience was at that private residence house in Kentville, Nova Scotia. And this is a really cool case because it had some natural phenomena happening, but it also had some supernatural phenomena happening. So a family reached out to us and said that they had just purchased a home that was built in the 1800s. They'd only lived there for 6 months and they were experiencing some unusual things. They said that there was pennies materializing around the house. They said one of their basset hounds had passed away and they were seeing the apparition of the basset hound. They would see an apparition of a female walk down their stairs. And they were also experiencing some faces showing up in photographs. So the case certainly had my interest. So I got together a small team. We went down to their house. And of course, when we got there, it was all cleaned up. They showed us a jar of pennies that had allegedly materialized. And I mean, I wasn't too blown away by that. I mean, it could have just been a jar that they were collecting and saving pennies in. So anyway, we checked the entire house. It was all clean and, of course, did our base readings with all the equipment that we had. So the digital thermometer and the electromagnetic field radiation detector. We were getting hit by the stairs where they would see the female apparition come down. And it was significantly high. It was above 3.0 milligauss, which, according to the FDA, is not a healthy reading to have. So that was interesting. And then the husband had gone to bed with the two girls, and it was early in the morning, between the hours of 1 and 3, I would hazard a guess without pulling the case report. And I had one of my investigators going to check the camera battery and the tape every hour on the hour to make sure it's still recording, everything's good. And on this one particular time, when he went up to go check the tape, sure enough, there was a penny that had materialized right by the base of the tripod. And, where the camera was situated at, there was only one way in, one way out. And we were sitting in the living room, which was the one way in, one way out. So nobody had gone over near that camera at all. You could hear us kind of chatting in the background on the camera. And then whenever the investigator would go check the tape and the battery level, you could hear him get off the couch and walk towards the camera. So at no time did he bend down. And he certainly didn't drop the penny from where he was standing, because you would have heard the metal hit the floor. And of course, where it was at the base of the tripod, it was outside of the camera's range. So we didn't get it on camera, but we certainly know that the penny had definitely materialized there. So with the high EMF readings and the penny appearing there, you know, I thought it was worth doing a second night investigation. So we asked the family if we can come back. And this time I brought a bigger team. I doubled the bodies. And we had a team outside, team inside. Team outside was using night vision. And at one point during the night, I could hear one of my investigators on the two-way radio asking if there was anybody upstairs. And there was nobody upstairs at the time. So he told the other investigator outside to keep watching the night vision, and he's going to go into the house and check. When he went into that upstairs bedroom, he said he opened the door, and there was a apparition of a little girl sitting on the bed. And after he composed himself, he got on the radio and called us up, and there were six of us up in the room. And the EMF reader was going at that time, and it was going towards the closet. And one of the investigators opened up the closet door, and at the exact same time, all six of us felt this ice-cold Arctic. And I policed up in Yellowknife, which is the sub-Arctic of Canada, so I've experienced cold. But this was even colder than that. It went like right through us, took our breath away for a second. And then one of the members of my team at the time was a reverend. So he said a couple prayers. And then all of a sudden, the EMF reader stopped. And everyone kind of felt calm and peace in the room. And the cold and the EMF readings just dissipated. So continued on that night. Nothing else crazy happened. There was no pennies that materialized that time. But we solved the EMF readings by the bottom of the stairs. So one of my investigators had the idea to cut the power to the house. So we went downstairs, turned the breaker off. And, of course, the reading stopped. So he turned the power back on and the reading came back. So he asked me to stomp my foot where I was standing upstairs, and he followed the power lines that were running underneath the house. And when he got to where I was, because the home was built in the 1800s, by that point, the wires had become so unshielded that it was giving off excessive amounts of electromagnetic radiation. So obviously we told the homeowners, you know, about that, and hopefully they got it fixed and repaired. And then the last thing that we kind of saw for them was the photos and in the faces in the photos. So what it was is in this old 1800 home, the wood on the door frames was painted with this like high gloss. So anytime that they were taking photos, it was the light reflecting back to the camera that would make it look like a face, which is called visual pareidolia. So that's when our mind, there's visual and audio pareidolia, and that's when the mind tries to make sense of something that doesn't make sense to it. So that's why you can listen to an electronic voice phenomena and think that you hear something, or you can look up at a cloud, and if you look at it long enough, you'll see a dragon or a butterfly or whatever your mind's trying to tell you that it is. So in that case, that's what was happening in the photos, because we were able to replicate them perfectly. So it's a cool case, because there's certainly a few different supernatural elements to it, like the penny materializing 100% happened. My investigator seeing the apparition 100% happened. But then there was some other, you know, normal scientific stuff happening, like the excessive amount of radiation coming off the unshielded wires and the pareidolia. So very, very interesting case.
It's too bad it was only a penny each time, right? It should have been like $100 bill. That would have been,
I know,
that would have been all right.
I know. It's funny. There's been lots of cases of ghosts leaving, you know, pennies, dimes, even coins, like foreign coins. But it doesn't seem to be paper bills, which I always had a theory that possibly it's something to do with the metal and them being energy and having to use that energy to do something with the metal, especially pennies back in the day, because they had copper in them, and copper is a conductor for electricity. So,
you belong to you're part of the PPRI?
Yeah, PPRI. So it's Paranormal Phenomena Research and Investigation. I started that back in 1997. We're registered with the Nova Scotia Registry of Joint Stocks, and we're also registered federally in Canada under the Not-for-Profit Corporations Act. And we're also incorporated in the state of Massachusetts, because we serve the public in the New England area, and we also serve the public in Atlantic Canada. We also have an application in right now to the Canada Revenue Agency, which is the equivalent of the IRS, to get charity status. And there is one other kind of supernatural organization in Canada called the Survival Research Institute out in Vancouver, British Columbia, that managed to get charity status. So we're hoping that you know, we get that. And then if we do, we can get some more perks to give free services back to the public. You know, one perk that you get is you can get Google ad grants, for example. So we can run ads on the internet, ask for cases, or use some of that money to advertise educational products or anything like that. So that's kind of what PPRI does, is, you know, investigations, research, and education. Those are our three mandates.
And you're also the vice president of the Ghost Project Canada. What kind of responsibilities do you have with that?
Yeah, so Ghost Project Canada is a long-term phenomenological study that Daryl Walsh and I are running. And it's basically just collecting stories of the supernatural to analyze them. And my co-founder of PPRI is a chief executive officer of Get Fused, which is a digital marketing technology web development company based out of Boston. He has some big clients like UFC, Tap Out, and New England Patriots, to name his top three clients. But he's currently developing a database so that the public can go on and submit their experience to us. It'll go to an investigator, and then we can sort it out. And then all the stuff that we've collected through Ghost Project Canada, we can input. And what it'll do is it's going to break down somebody's supernatural story. So it'll be, what is the phenomenon? Is it a UFO sighting? Is it a ghost sighting? Where was it at? Is it in Nova Scotia? Is it in Halifax, Nova Scotia? What was the weather like at the time? Was it dark and stormy? Was it sunny and bright? And just kind of pick apart all the details and try and see what kind of trends, when you extrapolate all that data, what kind of trends show up. And then there will be an interactive map available to the public. So if you're interested in like what we have on New York State, you can go to New York State and see all the different stories and events that we've collected. And you might, you know, like you said, you just read that book where you found something, you know, not too far from your house that, you know, if we upload it to the database, people will have access to that. So that's kind of a long-term project, but we're hoping to have the first version available on the internet by the end of this year. That's Spencer's goal. He's currently developing it and has to work with his designers and all this information technology people and stuff. So we're really excited about that project.
Oh, by the way, we might be experiencing something soon, because you just froze for like a good like 20 seconds. My whole computer just froze for like a good like 15 seconds. And that never happens. That never happens.
It's funny because I heard something and it wasn't you talking. It wasn't me talking. So yeah, I kind of heard something come over over there. So yeah.
I'm telling you, man. It's because I said what I said. You know, I know there's something here. All right, guys, you don't have to prove it to me. I don't know. You know, like I said, I try not to get anything because my kids, and you know, I don't want to frighten anybody. You know, like it still scares me to a point too. I mean, I'm going to be 41 in a couple of weeks. You know, it's still, of course, it scares me because I don't know what the hell is going on. But at the same time, you're just like, okay, I get it. You're here. You're trying to tell me you're here. I understand. I know you're here. I believe in you. Now, please just leave me alone. You know, but
yeah. Well, that's the difficulty is, like as a correctional officer, as a police officer, if we have to deal with somebody, like we can physically grapple them. We know we can control them.
Right.
We probably know who they are. We have background information on them. With the supernatural, I mean, we don't know who we're dealing with. We don't know who's in the house.
Right.
You know, is it a discarnate entity? Is it an inhuman spirit? They may be able to do certain things to kind of communicate with us, like, you know, tap and knock and move things. But, you know, can they hear what we're saying? Do they understand what we're saying? So it is fearful. Number one, because it's the unknown. And of course, we're always afraid of the unknown, sure. But it is fearful because there's a lot we don't understand about it. And, you know, I think it's just natural to feel that way.
So, you know, just getting back a little bit, at the time of this interview that we're talking right now, you've authored two books. Can you tell us a little bit about them, you know, and share an excerpt if you can? I'd love to hear an excerpt from sure, the law enforcement.
Actually,
one.
My third one just came out last week.
Oh, great.
So my first one was Evil in Exeter. That was, again, based on haunting that I investigated in Exeter, Rhode Island, involving a family. It was kind of if it wasn't a dynamic entity, it was certainly not a very nice entity. The woman involved in the investigation had actually seen the entity once when she was a teenager, and it had no eyes. It was just black, complete black, almost like black eye sockets. So and she was on the television show Ghost Hunters.
Nice.
They did an episode on the house in Cranston, which is not the house I investigated. I did Exeter. But she's had spirits around her whole life. And she thinks it's because three different mediums have told her she has that psychic ability. And so they're drawn towards her energy, and they think that she can help them, but she doesn't have the skill sets to do that. So obviously things are attracted to her. And we talked to the family priest about the apparition that she had seen. And he said himself that if it's not dynamic, then it would be what the Catholic Church would consider a damned soul. And they would just treat that soul the same way that they would the dynamic, basically. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, certainly there was lots of crazy stuff that was happening in that file. I saw doors open and close on their own, lock and unlock on their own. I saw electronics be manipulated. Had kids not sleep for 4 days.
Wow.
Because they heard scratching on their wall when there was nothing there. Fire alarms would go off, and they'd only turn off if they were splashed with holy water. Just crazy, crazy stuff. House flies. There was hundreds of house flies appearing, almost like that scene in Amityville Horror. Sure. Strange, strange stuff. Then my second book. So after I finished writing the first book, my mother wanted me to try and write a second book. I said, well, these types of cases don't come along every day. Like, this is probably the biggest case I worked and ever will work probably in the field of parapsychology. But I started thinking, you know, what's some other things I could write about? Like, maybe I could check my old case file, see if there's any interesting cases there. But then I started to think about my two passions, which is parapsychology and law enforcement. So what I did is just reach out to a few people that were in the field, and they had some stories. So I started with some sheriff friends. They gave me some stories about the courthouse in Halifax being haunted. And then, of course, when I go on podcasts, people would hear that I'm, you know, researching this, and that I'm a retired police officer. So I'd have people contact me. And before I knew it, I had like 50 different stories that were all from law enforcement.
Wow.
And so that's where supernatural encounters, true paranormal accounts from law enforcement came from. And then once that book came out, it was actually very well received. I was getting messages from law enforcement all over the place, and sold quite a few books. And before I knew it, I collected 41 more stories, all true and all nonfiction from law enforcement.
Wow.
And so more supernatural encounters from law enforcement, which is my third book, was just released on October 26th.
Wow. Excellent. Excellent. Do you have anything handy? Can you share an excerpt of anything from any of the books?
Yeah. So one of my favorite stories in more supernatural encounters from law enforcement came from a police officer that was working in Stellarton, Nova Scotia. He's working a night shift, and he was in the dispatcher's office just chatting to the dispatcher, trying to kill time. And a call came in, and it was from a Canada Post janitor. And he was cleaning the post office, and he could hear a domestic disturbance going on upstairs. He said there was a woman screaming like she was being murdered. There was furniture being thrown and broken. It sounded like somebody got thrown through drywall, and he phoned 911. So the post office is literally like three buildings down from the police station. So it was faster for the police officer to grab his partner in the bullpen and just run down to the post office rather than go out the back door, get in the police car, go through the secure gate and head down. So he hears this call come in from the dispatcher. So there's no time delay, runs out to the bullpen, grabs his female partner. They run down the road. They go to the post office. Janitor lets them upstairs because in the upstairs part of the post office, apparently there's a couple of apartments for rent, but they should be vacant. So he opens up the apartment, the police go in, and there's nothing. There's no power connected to it. There's no furniture in the place. It's completely empty. Hasn't been used in a long time. So they search each room. And when they get to the last room, he has the idea to take his flashlight out and roll it across the floor. And when he does that, he can see that there's a fine layer of dust on the floor. So he goes back out into the hallway and does it out there. And all he can see are the two sets of footprints, one from him, one from his partner. And there's nothing else. So they cleared the apartment and they brought the janitor and they said, listen, man, there's nothing in here. There's nobody in here. And of course, the janitor's losing his mind. He's like, I'm telling you right now, there was a huge domestic disturbance. Sounded like somebody was being murdered. They must be on top of the roof. And so the police officer's like, well, we just ran down here. We didn't hear anything, didn't see anything. How do you get to the roof? And he said, you can only get to the roof through this apartment. And he brings them over to the window where the fire escape is. But when they had touched up the apartment, somebody was lazy and kind of painted over the windowsill. So it was one of those situations where the window was basically painted shut. So the police examined the window and said, listen, man, like this window's sealed shut. Like nobody's up there. And of course, the Canada Post janitor's losing his mind. And they said, listen, we're not saying we don't believe you. We're just saying, like, whatever happened, like they're people are gone or they're not here anymore. So they go back to the office to write up the report. And then they go home to sleep for that morning. And the chief of police calls him around noontime. He answers the phone and the chief's kind of laughing. And he says, tell me about that call you went to last night. So he tells him the whole story. And he said, he goes, that's interesting. He goes, that's not the first time we've been called to that apartment. And he says, well, what do you mean? He said, well, one time we were called there for the same thing, but it was during the daytime hours. And the two Canada Post employees that were working at the post office could hear the exact same thing. And of course, they called it in because they had customers there and police found nothing. Same thing. Apartment was vacant. But he said the real thing about this apartment is a few years ago, there was actually a murder in there where the woman was murdered with a bread knife, like a butter knife, by her partner. And it was like a really gruesome murder. And so since that happened, they've had two calls to that apartment, where it sounds like a woman is being literally murdered. And so I think about hauntings, and this almost sounds like a residual haunting. And because the murder was so violent and so gruesome at the time, that somehow the environment has imprinted that psychic energy into it. And every once in a while, for whatever reason, it's almost like a video recording and it'll kind of replay that scene out. That's probably one of the cooler stories that I came across when I was researching this one. I love that one. I think it's really, really fascinating. Cool. The only problem with investigating residual hauntings is you never know when they're going to happen.
Right. Right.
It's not like a active or intelligent haunting where it's kind of happening all the time. With residual haunting, it could happen only once a year. It could be on the death of the woman's anniversary of the death, or it could be only during a thunderstorm. Like you need more data, I guess, to kind of focus, because you could literally sit in that apartment for 5 weeks and have nothing.
Right. Happen. Right. Sure. Now you've been on some TV shows. Which TV shows have you been on?
Yeah. I was on, it was called Truth Seekers with Discovery Channel.
Nice.
That was many years ago. I've helped out on Daryl's television show called Shadow Hunter. I actually were looking for people with psychic experiences, and my mother kind of has that gift, although she tries to turn it off because it always freaks her out. Things always seem to come true. So I helped introduce them to that. Also helped out on the TV series that just came out called Sightseers, which is about a oracle and a medium that get together. And the oracle is blind. But he's very talented at, he can touch your hands, and he's very talented at like getting information from you that way. And then of course, with, Daryl, and my friend, Donna Davies, who's a film producer, we're working on a television series that hopefully will start filming in April of next year. So certainly done a little bit, mostly podcasts. Love coming on podcasts and sharing my knowledge, and especially like trying to, you know, dispel some myths about parapsychology. You know, one that I always hit on is that it's a social science, not a pseudoscience. And the other one is with the ghost shows, how they all always investigate in the dark, and how that is strictly done for dramatics and entertainment purposes only. And we know that because similar project to Ghost Project Canada was run by the Society for Psychical Research, Eleanor Sedgwick. And what she did is she took hundreds of ghost sighting cases and analyzed them. And what she was able to determine is that ghosts can show up day, night, indoors, outdoors, sunny, rainy. There's no rhyme or reason why somebody would have a sighting, kind of thing. And we're trained to only investigate in the dark if your client says that something's only happening in a certain area in the dark. Other than that, you should have the lights on, and basically, you know, it's a fallacy, and it's only done for dramatics.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good way of doing it too. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I agree with that, because all these shows, you know, like we touched on it before too, but all these shows, like you said, it's all dramatic. I used to live in Staten Island when I was younger. And one of the hot spots, I guess you would say, is a place called the Old Bermuda Inn. And it's basically the quintessential story of, you know, this girl used to live there, and she was about to get married to this guy. He went off to the war, and she used to wait for him by the, you know, by the window every night, and he never came home. So, you know, she basically died of a broken heart, and people still say that they see her in this window, and, you know, throughout the, you know, because now it's a catering hall. And people still see her, and there's a painting of her that went up in flames, you know, without any, you know, without anything letting it go up in flames and stuff like that. And yeah, so I definitely hear you with that. And I completely lost my train of thought, because I'm looking at this meter over here, and for some reason it's going up and down when it shouldn't be. But I'm going to have to listen to all this stuff back and see if I catch anything, because that would be pretty crazy. I actually caught an EVP from when I was talking to Carl Johnson, who's a very respected demonologist. And I had asked him a question about the Ouija board, and right before he was about to answer, an EVP came along. I didn't hear it, of course, until after, when I was reviewing it. And, you know, I'm not, like you had said earlier about, you know, people hearing things, I don't like to do that. You know, maybe it's my law enforcement brain, maybe it's just because I've been into this stuff for so long. I don't like to guess, you know, like, oh, well, you know, what did it say? Did it say this? You know, I like to show it to people and be like, what do you think it said? You know, and of course you're going to get different things from different people all the time, you know, because it's so hard to hear some of these things. But yeah, you know, one person had said that, oh my God, it said, you know, because I think my question was, do you think that spirits could actually communicate through the Ouija board? And somebody was like, oh my God, it said, yes, it can, you know, stuff like that, which, I mean, yeah. It was crazy. I mean, it's wild sometimes, you know, like I said, doing this podcast, I guess it invites things sometimes, which, you know, I don't really want, but it's pretty crazy in itself. So
that is crazy. It's interesting you mentioned Carl Johnson too. He just joined us about 2 months
really?
Ago. We were looking to increase our numbers in the New England state area, because I only had Spencer and Mike, and we want to try and eventually have six in New England, six in Nova Scotia. We just got our sixth person now in Nova Scotia, and we have five now in New England, and Carl Johnson's one of them. So yeah, he's got some good stories.
What a great guy too. What a great guy. Yeah. And very, very funny too. I mean, he's a ball buster. You could tell he's a ball buster. I liked his personality the second I started talking to him. So at the moment, what are you currently working on? You know,
with everything?
I'm kind of glad that October's over with, because it's always a busy month. So right now, just kind of housekeeping stuff with, you know, PPRI. I have to get the year-end finances done up. We have a couple of investigations on the go. We've got three private residences we're working on. One is in New Waterford, Nova Scotia, where the family's experiencing a haunting. Some people have seen apparitions in the house. House is built in 1800s, so it's got a lot of history to it. Another case that we're working on is a spectrophilia type case, where a client has claimed a couple of years ago that she was sexually assaulted by a spirit. Wow. And currently has issues when they're trying to sleep of things walking across the bed, trying to keep her awake all night. So we've been working on that case, which is really interesting. We're not sure if it's supernatural or not. It could be a sleep-wake condition. A lot of sleep-wake conditions, the hallucinations aren't just visual. They can be auditory as well, and they can also be through touch as well, so tactile hallucinations. So really interesting case. Third case is also interesting because it's in Nova Scotia, and it's a private residence, and it's a male that's claiming that he's being woken up, and every time he tries to sleep, something blows in his face and blows in his ear. Wow. And kind of pinches the back of his neck. So there's something going on right now where spirits are not letting people sleep. Hmm. Or you know, the COVID isolation is getting to people, or there's something going on. It's very interesting. Other than that, I'm trying to get the last thing I'm trying to do before the year end is we're developing an introduction to parapsychology mm-hmm. course. We're going to get a subscription to Moodle. Nice. And do it all through that, through Moodle and Zoom, similar to what the Ryan Education Center does. It'll be 8-week program. It'll cover, you know, everything that falls under ESP, nice. Mind matter interaction, psychokinesis, and of course all the different survival topics. Going to pair up with Daryl Walsh to do that, because he taught again at Nova Scotia Community College those two courses, and then I used to help assist him in teaching those, so I do have some experience teaching it. And I also do lectures all around Halifax Regional Municipality on ghosts, hauntings, apparitions, poltergeists, and demons. So it should be fun. And then what we're going to do is any sort of tuition that we collect from that is going to go straight back into the organization, so that we can purchase equipment and help keep, you know, we have a 1-844 number, which is like a 1-800 number that we run. We run the website. We're developing this database. We always purchase new equipment. For example, we just recently added a gas detector to our equipment this year, because there's been a couple studies now that have shown that excessive amounts of carbon monoxide can cause people to experience hauntings. Sure. There was a case in 1921 where a family was experiencing a haunting, called in some psychical researchers. They found out that the furnace was giving off excessive amounts of carbon monoxide. Wow. They fixed it. Haunting went away. As recently as 2005, a lady was getting a shower and a ghost materialized in front of her in the shower. So, of course, she freaked out, called some paranormal investigators, and they were able to find out that the recently installed water heater that she had had done was improperly installed and was actually giving off excessive amounts of carbon monoxide, which was causing her to hallucinate. Wow. So picked up a gas detector now, which can pick up oxygen, carbon monoxide, H2S gas, which is interesting because it has a sulfuric kind of smell. So if you have a dynamic case, that would be really handy for mm-hmm. that. And then a low-level explosive gas as well. So, you know, certainly there's always some new piece of equipment that would help our investigation. So really excited about that to hopefully start, you know, generating some revenue for the organization, especially, like I said, where we're trying to get charity status and do more things to generate money so that we can do different things, you know, down the road for the public. We always like to try and hold free events and everything comes out of our pocket right now, and it adds
up. Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
It's funny you say that too, with the carbon monoxide and everything like that. I guess, you know, a lot of people that they're so, you know, I guess being that we're in law enforcement as well, we try and look at it from different angles. You don't want to just look at it from one specific angle. You know, you have to go through the motions, you know, like, all right, you have to, you know, process of elimination. All right. It's not this, it's not this. Let's see if it's this, you know? And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that things like being so close to power lines or being so close to satellite dishes and stuff like that, that could actually, I believe that there's been studies showing that that could also cause certain phenomena or you to hallucinate certain things as well. You know, I guess as far as the electricity and stuff like that.
Yep, absolutely. Actually, at that house where the gentleman is claiming to have issues sleeping in two of the bedrooms, I found that the alarm clock was giving off excessive amounts of electromagnetic radiation. Mm. And there have been cases where the alarm clock's too close to somebody's bed and they always experience apparition at night. And it's been deemed to be the alarm clock once they replace it with a lower lower radiation type device there that the apparitions go away. In this case though, the poor guy has had to result to sleeping in his living room. Wow. And where he sleeps in his lounge chair, there's no excessive amounts of radiation coming there. So, but it was just interesting because like you said, we go into the house, you check for everything. Sure. And that was just something I mentioned to them. I just said, hey, if you're in this room downstairs or this room upstairs, just be cognizant that the alarm clock is giving off like unsafe amounts.
Wow.
Which can cause hallucinations.
See, that just shows people. You use your cell phone as your alarm clock, all right? I mean, I'm sure cell phones also give off some kind of radiation too. That's what they've been saying for years. But, you know, that's a perfectly good alarm clock, and it's probably louder than most alarm clocks nowadays.
For sure. Yeah. And it actually, a cell phone would give off a lower amount than what those clocks really? Were, for sure. Because I had two different EMF readers. I had a Lutron, old digital one, which I still use. And then I have a brand new one called the GQ390, which is really cool. It's all digital. You can actually plug it into your computer and it will download all the data from your investigation for you. So there's no more going into a room and writing down what it was at what time. It's all tracked on the device. But it actually will try and tell you what it thinks it is. So if you hold your cell phone too close to it, it'll actually say Wi-Fi/cellular signal.
Wow, that's a great tool.
So it's really cool. So if you do get a hit on that one, it'll try and tell you what it is. Like I know when I held it towards the breaker box, it told me that it could tell it was live wires and that it was electricity.
One more quick thing too. You had said that, you know, you do a lot of these residential investigations and stuff, and you said that you just recruited Carl. When you guys do these residential investigations, do you go in there specifically to just basically tell somebody, oh yeah, it's haunted or it's not haunted, or do you try to help them to rid, you know, the residents of these entities?
I'm glad you asked that because there's a lot of investigator groups that don't actually help the client. Right. You always hear stories about how, you know, like somebody reaches out to them, they'll go there with a bunch of fancy equipment, tramp around their house for a couple hours, tell them whether or not it's haunted or not, and then leave. Right. And it doesn't actually solve their problem. So what I do is when somebody contacts us, we're a reactive organization rather than a proactive organization. So we don't go to graveyards and we're not going to abandoned hospitals and things like that, just looking for business or drumming things up. We strictly react to requests that come into us. So I always ask the client, what is it that you're looking for? So for example, like the last couple of clients have told us that they're looking for some sort of understanding on what's happening at their home. And if it is supernatural, like why is it happening to them kind of thing? And of course they want it to stop. So like the one client in Ontario with the spectrophilia case, we had to think outside the box on this one. We wanted to do kind of an observation of her sleeping. And we had to rig up a Zoom meeting and her iPad. So she had to plug her iPad in. I would set up a Zoom meeting. She would sign in before she went to bed and it would record her sleeping all night. And then the next day, we'd have an investigator review the video surveillance and see if anything happened. And we would also ask her what her experience was. Since we started doing that, she's actually been able to sleep properly. So it's really interesting. That's why for that case in particular, I'm kind of leaning towards it could possibly be a sleep-wake disorder.
By that you mean like a sleep paralysis type thing? Is that
sort of? Yeah, because with sleep paralysis, there can be hallucinations as well. There can also be again the textile hallucinations. Sure. So she may very well have been sexually assaulted by a spirit a couple of years ago, but it is also possible that there was a life event that happened to her, a divorce. Basically, and that could be really traumatizing for people. And that's where my background in counseling psychology, is helpful as well. Sure. So that event, when that happened, that seemed to have triggered the supernatural phenomena in her life. So between that and the sleep-wake disorder, that's kind of what we're leaning towards on that case, for sure.
So if someone wanted to contact you or buy your books or learn more about your organizations that you're with, how could they do that?
Well, the best method to do that would be to go to the PPRI website, which is just ppri.net. It's got all kinds of different links on there. There's a store link. If you click the store link, it has links to my books and Daryl Walsh's books, because he's written a few as well. And it brings you to Amazon or Chapters or Barnes & Noble, whoever had the best and cheapest price. Right now it's Amazon. It's pretty hard to beat those big companies. It also has resources on there as well. So I only list like reputable organizations. So the Rhine and there's the International Near Death Experience Organization. And then I just recently put under a resource section also parapsychological studies. So anyone that's actually interested in like real studies that are done in the laboratory, you can go to this section. And I've listed a few PDF documents that are the full research papers, and also put in brackets why it's important. So for example, under extrasensory perception, you'll see the Pierce-Pratt experiment, which was done by J.B. Rhine. And that experiment's really important because that showed that distance does not affect ESP. So if you have a reputable psychic that, you know, say there's a psychic in Florida that you know is reputable, but you're in New York, and you're worried about calling him and like, is this real? And is he going to be able to give a reading with me? Well, according to that study, distance doesn't affect ESP. Mm. So if he is a true medium and he has that ability, then he should be able to assist you over the telephone. So studies like that are really important for people to know and to understand. So I started to include those on our website as well. But that is like the gold mine of information. It's got our contact information on there, social media accounts, all that stuff.
Excellent. Excellent. And I'll definitely, link everything to the show notes as well. And thank you so much for this interview, man. I really appreciate it. We've been talking for a little while over the messages and stuff, and I'm glad we finally got to do this. So thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate that.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me. I was looking forward to this one. Great. And if I ever write a third book on law enforcement and the supernatural, it sounds like you've had a couple of experiences that we just kind of touch base on your podcast there. So couple. I'd definitely be interested in talking to you about those.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, I would definitely. I would love that. So thanks again, man. I appreciate it. And I'll let you know when I'm going to air this.
Awesome. Sounds great.
Have a good night, man.
Okay, right. You too. Take care.
Bye. So that'll do it for me, guys. Episode 11 in the books. Thank you to Dr. Van Dusen for the awesome interview. Thank you to April for her awesome segment. Thank you to the contributors that helped me put the show together and to help me out a little bit. So I appreciate all you guys. I appreciate you, the listeners, because you're the reason why I keep doing it.
Remember, 845-379-1331, ghostshowny@gmail.com. You could do so anonymously. All of the social media links are on warpedrealitypodcast.com, so please check it out. Leave me a review if you like the show. Have a good night, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Warped Reality Podcast. For more episodes, guest info, social media links, merch, and more, please check out warpedrealitypodcast.com. If you have a paranormal experience you'd like to share, questions, comments, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, you can leave me a voicemail at 845-379-1331 or email me at ghostshowny@gmail.com. You could do so anonymously if you'd like. Also, I'd greatly appreciate it if you could leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or warpedrealitypodcast.com. Have an awesome night, everyone, and don't forget to change your shorts.